Looks like we picked a bad day to start believing in the stock market rally, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, August the 20th. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And I'll tell you what, I'm just going to wait a beat here for the music to clear so that I can do this. All right, we set? All right, here it is. Hit it. I know, it's nice to be able to pick the music, huh? One hates to make too much of a single day in the notoriously fickle capital markets, but it is worth observing here for just a moment the breadth of the misery on Wall Street today. Media companies, chip makers, banks, nobody came up smelling like roses. If you're looking for a culprit, uncertainty would be a really good one. The Dow off some 360 points on questions like these. What is the Fed going to do? What's going on in China? And what about oil, by the way? The markets hate questions like that, as you know. All right, moving on. A story from the intersection of pharmaceuticals and mergers and acquisitions. Just a day or so after Sprout Pharmaceuticals won FDA approval for its female libido pill, Valeant Pharmaceuticals swooped in with a billion-dollar buyout. Or, as we said around here this morning, another day, another pharmaceutical merger. KPMG, the consulting company, says that in just the first half of 2015, we saw almost a quarter trillion dollars worth of pharma deals. That is three times the same period a year ago. So from the health desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more on M&A on drugs.
The pharmaceutical industry has kind of exploded over the last decade or so. The early stage R&D work traditionally done by the Mercks and Pfizers of the world is now also being done by small startups. Avalere's Dan Mendelsohn says that's possible as DNA sequencing, molecular modeling, and powerful computer costs have plummeted.
It used to be that you needed a huge amount of scale to be able to comb through millions of compounds. And now, you know, drug development is really more about the clinical brain power and less about brawn.
An army of entrepreneurs has entered the industry and is doing early and mid-stage research. With more people in the pool, Big Pharma has developed a new set of skills, namely knowing how to shop for the next blockbuster. Stephen Goldman, an M&A attorney at Cramer Levin, says that's why so many drug makers are snapping up these promising biotechs.
This is their business, and they need to be players in it. And so they're buying these companies.
So, to some extent, traditional R&D by the largest manufacturers is being replaced by smaller outfits. Northwestern's Craig Garthwaite says the question is whether this new model's actually more expensive.
I don't think there's anything inherent in it that we're going to spend more on drugs because we're doing it out of the company as opposed to in the company.
Garthwaite says no one studied that question, and given the concern over the rising cost of drugs, it may be worth taking a look. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A detour now to the downside of the sharing economy. Regulators here in Uber's home state of California say they have evidence that the ride-hailing service failed to screen out 25 drivers with criminal records, including convictions for kidnapping and for murder. The other day, there was a sexual assault claim made against an Airbnb host over in Madrid, Spain. It is a big, tangled mess of convenience and consumer safety, this whole thing is. Definitely bad for business and in need, perhaps, of a reality check. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes it from there.
The headlines have been unflattering. Assault, rape, alleged failure to do proper background checks. But headlines are not statistics.
You know, to paint a broad brush to say that there are major trust issues or safety issues in the sharing economy, in my opinion, is a bit of sensationalism.
Billy Howard is author of the book WeCommerce. According to Airbnb, less than 1 in 67,000 stays results in a complaint of property damage. And serious complaints by guests are extremely rare. But the horror stories certainly get people talking, says UNC entrepreneurship professor Arvind Malhotra.
Similar issues, when they crop up in diverse locations, tend to indicate possible system breakdown.
Malhotra says it's a double risk to sharing economy firms because bad stories can scare away customers and suppliers, drivers, hosts. And that's what many proponents of the sharing economy say will drive improvements. Arun Sundararajan teaches at NYU's Stern School.
In the American economy, what we've traditionally done is let the market provide what it can and then have the government step in and surgically correct market failures.
And government regulations aren't foolproof themselves. Matthew Mitchell is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center.
Ironically, highly regulated industries like taxi industries have some of the worst safety and quality records, in part because the regulations have protected incumbents from any sort of competition that might serve customers better.
Then again, we don't let businesses develop their own fire codes. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Oh, by the way, before we move on, there's Greece news you ought to know about. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras says he is going to step down and call new elections as a way to make sure that the bailout he agreed to a month ago actually does happen. Referendum part two, you might call this one. Circle September 20th on your calendars, by the way. On Wall Street today, well, I believe we've covered that already, haven't we? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today is, as it happens, National Radio Day, so chalk one up for us, and thanks for listening, by the way. Along those lines, I heard the other day that August is National Catfish Month, a month where the contributions the catfish industry makes to the American economy are recognized. Most of the catfish produced in this country are produced in Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. We know a catfish farmer down in Greensboro, Alabama. His name is Townsend Kaiser. We call him up from time to time just to chat. Mr. Kaiser, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Good to talk to you.
Let me ask you this first of all. Does National Catfish Month mean anything to you?
It means a whole lot to me and a lot of people in the South.
Yeah.
A lot of jobs in our area in Alabama as well as Mississippi and other places of the South depend on catfish for their livelihood, and National Catfish Month is a great way for us to share our product with everyone else.
Is summer a good season for you guys? Is it busy?
Summer's a busy, long season. That's our feeding season, but, you know, if we can't feed them, we can't grow them.
Yeah, I guess so. How does one feed a catfish, by the way?
We blow out a floating pellet made predominantly of corn and soybeans and some vitamins with a truck and blow it out on top of the water, and the fish come along and eat it.
Gotcha.
We probably feed 40 tons of feed a day.
Wow.
Probably about 4,000 to 5,000 tons of feed a year.
Do you ever get to go out on the water, as it were, or out on the truck doing the feeding, or are you stuck in the office doing the boring stuff?
A little bit of everything. I enjoy getting out there feeding, but sometimes I get stuck in the office getting to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. Last time we spoke to you, which was October-ish of last year, you were getting about $1.15 a pound
for
your catfish. Your price is holding steady?
They're a little bit below that. They're about $1.05, but the price of feed has dropped $40 a ton, so that kind of helps even things out.
Yeah, it helps you out. The reason I ask is because, you know, the big story these days is inflation and what's the Federal Reserve going to do and all that. Are you even worried about that, or are you just keeping your head down and feeding your catfish?
I'm keeping my head down, feeding my catfish. That's above my pay grade.
How big are they when they come out of the water and you take them to market?
A pound and a half to 2 pounds is the optimum size for a catfish.
How many do you grow how many do you take to market in a year or in a season?
4 to 5 million pounds.
Wow, at a pound and a half to two, that's like 2 to 2.5 million fish.
Something like that, yes, sir.
Now, is this your business that you started, or did your family start it way back, or what?
Well, it's a family business. We started in the late 60s, 1967, with my grandfather, and my father's still around, and my brother and I are carrying on the tradition as third generation catfish farmers.
Does your father still come into work?
He still comes into work every day and tells us what we did wrong.
What you did wrong. Never what you did right, though, I guess, huh?
Oh, no, sir.
Townsend Kaiser at Kaiser Farms out in Greensboro, Alabama, raises catfish down there. Mr. Kaiser, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Rizdahl. Have a nice afternoon.
You too. Coming up.
They said, you have to move, and here's $8,000. And I said, no, thank you.
We go back to Highland Park and update our series from last fall, York and Fig. But first, let's do the numbers. Twice in one day, it doesn't get any better than that, does it? The Dow Industrials off 358 points, 2%, fell below 17,000, 16,990 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ surrendered 141 points, 2.8%, 4877 at the bell. The S&P 500 dropped 43 points, 2%, finished at 2,035. Here we are, by the way, almost the end of summer, and the S&P is below where it started the year, if you're one who keeps track of those kinds of things. Is your department store a Beals, Goodies, or a Peebles? If so, chances are you live in a small-ish city. Those are all owned by Stage Stores, which operates 840 stores. It's closing a whole bunch of them, citing economic softness, mainly in the oil patch. Stage Stores down 29%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.07%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In the dozens of wildfires burning throughout the West right now, there are countless individual stories. Three firefighters were killed yesterday in eastern Washington state. Thousands of people have been ordered to evacuate. Hundreds of homes and buildings have already been destroyed, and more than 230,000 acres have burned in Washington state alone. It is, by almost any definition of the word, a disaster. The governor of Washington has asked for a federal disaster declaration to get more money to fight the fires. The National Forest Service wants wildfires to be considered natural disasters, which would also free up more money for fighting and maybe even preventing them. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the rest of that story.
A cluster of wildfires have burned more than 200 square miles in central Washington, threatening the resort town of Chelan. After weeks, the fires are only 50% contained, but strong winds and extreme dryness aren't making it any easier. Thomas Gormley is general manager of Lakeside Lodge. His family hasn't lost any buildings, but...
This is the biggest month of the year, revenue-wise. We lost just about everything. I don't think that insurance-wise we would get any help, assistance there. I'm sure there may be some relief from the government, but I'm not so sure what that would be.
Tourism isn't the only thing these small communities in central and eastern Washington rely on. The timber industry has been a major source of revenue. These fires are causing the loss of major logging dollars, so says Jerry Bonagofsky. He's president of the Washington Contract Loggers Association.
Right now, virtually most of eastern Washington is at a fire precaution level 4, which means there's no industrial activity at all allowed.
And then there's the cost of trying to put all these fires out. Almost 20 fires are active in Washington alone. Where's this money going to come from? Mike Ferris is with the U.S. Forest Service.
We'll probably tap what we have available this year. It's likely we're going to have to tap what we have available and exceed it.
The U.S. Forest Service expects to spend more than half of its budget on fighting fires this year. But it's the mega fires, like the one threatening Chelan, that they want to be deemed natural disasters and subsequently be funded like the way we treat floods or hurricanes. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We did a series last year called York and Fig. Our wealth and poverty team wanted to see what happens when a working class neighborhood, in this case, Highland Park here in Los Angeles, what happens when it changes? What happens when gentrification comes to town? When you talk to economists and sociologists, they'll tell you that one of the hardest things to figure out is what happens to the people who get displaced when a neighborhood changes like Highland Park has been changing. So today, the story of one particular building in Highland Park. It's a residential hotel for low-income men up on the top floor, with mom-and-pop vendors selling discounted goods downstairs. When we told you about this building last fall, we were with a real estate agent who was looking in the windows, imagining what that building could be.
This could be broken up into like two or three little cute boutiques, and that's probably going to happen soon.
Here's Marketplace's Chrissy Clark with what did happen.
Before I get to what happened to the building itself, let me first tell you a little bit more about the people inside it, because there was way more to this building than what you could see when you peered in through the dusty windows or read the real estate brochure about it being a prime mixed-use opportunity. This building was filled with history and stories and all these characters.
Okay, I have to mention this guy. That was Crazy Ralph.
Crazy Ralph.
Crazy Ralph. And then you got Crazy Tony out there, and right in the room right across from me, Rodney, the Kool-Aid guy. They always drank Kool-Aid, you know?
John Piper, the guy rattling off that list, he was also a resident of this building for almost a decade. also a character. He's a former welder, former Air Force guy, former heavy metal drummer at the Excalibur in Las Vegas. John is in his 50s, disabled, lost most of the movement in his right hand after he collapsed during a pulmonary embolism. That was around the time he moved into this building.
It's such a good place to live for guys. And we can't help but like the place, you know. I mean, we got good rent, all utilities paid. I mean, I was able to open my window, look out right there on Figueroa. I could watch the parades. I could see them out the window and watch Santa Claus go by. What's not to really like about that?
There were definitely some things not to like about the place, though, John says. It was where people without a lot of other options came to live. There was an only half-joking joke around the building that once you moved in,
you leave in a bag.
During the years that John lived there, he says one resident died of a gunshot wound, another guy hanged himself, another died of lung cancer. But John says there was also this accidental, if slightly chaotic, community that formed among people on the edge who looked out for each other. He used to take one of his neighbors, who had a brain injury, to a food pantry at a local church once a month.
Way back when I first moved in there, and I was broke and trying to figure out how I was going to eat, you know. Him and I used to make sure we'd circle that date on the calendar, and we'd go down there and get groceries on that Thursday, you know what I mean? Because he needed somebody to help him out, you know.
Sometimes all the tenants would have barbecues on the roof together, watch fireworks on the 4th of July.
Hello. Hi. How are you guys?
Good, and you?
I'm good.
I first visited this building last fall, around the time that realtor was scoping it out for a couple of potential cute boutiques. A bunch of the tenants, including John Piper, were shooting the breeze downstairs. I asked them if I could pick their brain about the building.
He's the only one with the brain.
They told me the attention the building was getting was not lost on them. What might happen if the place got sold was actually a big topic of conversation. Carlos Valdez, who ran a little computer repair shop in the building, argued that a new owner could mean upgrades to the building, and that would be good for his business.
If you had landlords that would care about their building and go, hey, look, we got to improve for our tenants, I'm pro for it.
At this point, another guy, one of the other residential hotel tenants, Frank Valenzuela, interrupted. He said, no way. If this building gets bought,
you know, everyone would get evicted and the building would be refurbished into something else. Whoever buys it is just going to want to, okay, all the tenants out. Then we decide what's the best thing to do with it that's going to earn us back our investment. And then they're going to go with that. And I really doubt it's renting little rooms to crazy people. Never mind.
John Piper, the disabled drummer, was listening to them debate all this. And I asked him,
so if they sold the building, what would happen to you?
I'd probably go live with my brother's house at Redondo Beach or something. Probably be good for me.
That was almost a year ago. Since then, the building has been sold for $3.6 million. And John Piper did not end up in Redondo Beach.
How are you doing on this hot day?
Oh my gosh, it is a hot day.
Instead, he ended up in Van Nuys, another working-class neighborhood on the outskirts of Los Angeles, in this two-bedroom apartment that he shares with two other people.
And my room's a wreck still.
He pays $100 more than the unit he had to himself in Highland Park. It's the cheapest thing he could find. The last few months have been a scramble, John tells me. He says he was informed back in February, right after his birthday, that the residential hotel he lived in had been sold. He says the building manager and the new property manager told him the new owners were planning on renovating the building, maybe turning it into offices.
And everybody's going to need to move. I said, really? Everybody? Me and everybody that lives up here and like this whole swap mall and everybody? You mean? He goes, yeah. And I was like, wow. That really sucks.
When he finally found this new apartment in Van Nuys,
I didn't really want to move all the way out here.
It's about a 45-minute drive from his old neighborhood, which John says can feel isolating.
That's where I had all my connections and everything was right there, you know, in Highland Park. And I kind of miss living over there because it's now for me to do anything, I got to go drive all the way back over there.
The silver lining, he says, is he got some money from the building owners and he used some of it to buy a car, which he needs now since his new place is so far away. The money came out of a series of negotiations with the new owners, John says.
They said, you have to move and here's $8,000. And I said, no, thank you. Okay. So then they raised it to 10. And I said, nope. sorry. That's not the law. And I'm a true blue person, okay? I know what I'm entitled to. I've looked it up. I've found out. I know all. I got all the proof I need that if I had to go to court, this is the amount of money that I will get.
The amount John had in his head was a little over $19,000. That's how much a disabled person who's lived in a unit for more than 3 years is entitled to under Los Angeles rent control laws. John figured rather than fight for that money in court and have to hire a lawyer, he'd agree to less. He got $14,000. Between all the moving costs, staying in a hotel while he found a new, more expensive place, and buying a car, most of the money's already gone.
The money definitely helped, but look what it's taken me. Now I'm down to $1,500 now, you know?
But through all this, there's something that John did not know. Residential hotel units, like the one he lived in, have special protections in L.A. Landlords have to get city approval in order to convert them into an office building or anything else. Approvals his new property owners had not applied for yet. And in fact, John did not have to leave his apartment at all. He could have told the owners he wanted to stay. I explained this to John.
Did you know that?
No. Yeah, but they would have raised our rent astronomically.
I don't think they could, because it was rent controlled.
Yeah, because it was rent controlled. Yeah, I never even knew that they said I could have stayed. They never even mentioned it.
Tenants, they often don't know their rights.
Rafael Bostic is a housing expert and professor of public policy at USC. He says these kinds of negotiations happen all the time.
Most of these folks are not skilled, seasoned negotiators, whereas the developer is going to have a team of folks who this is what they do. So there definitely is the possibility for a tenant to agree to a worse deal than they might have otherwise been able to get.
I tracked down the new owner of the building, Tom Majic. He owns a real estate investment and development company in Los Angeles. He says he wasn't involved himself in the negotiation with John Piper. But in general, he says, it's up to tenants to know their own rights.
I'm not, you know, and this is like a derogatory word, but like I'm not their babysitter and I'm not their parent.
Tom says some of the residential hotel tenants didn't pay rent or were using or dealing drugs on the property. He told me he paid tenants to leave the property because he cares about the neighborhood. He wanted to clean it up.
Can I support everyone's challenge? Absolutely not. And I never can. But I very much care about this part of town. And it's because I care that we, you know, we made the investment so that it isn't an area where people are overdosing in our driveway, which happened. Like, we're going to prevent that.
Do you know where folks went, the people who did move out?
I know where one went. One went to Highland Park with his sister somewhere. But other than that one, I don't.
Do you wonder?
I don't.
Here's as complete a list as I could come up with of where people did end up. One guy moved in with his mom and used the buyout money he got to start school as a medical technician. Another took his money and bought a house out by the Salton Sea. And another is actually working for the new building owners. And of course, John Piper, the ex-drummer, lives with a bunch of roommates far away from his old stomping grounds in Highland Park.
My life is okay, but I'm not as happy as I was there.
As for Crazy Ralph and Crazy Tony and all the other guys, John says he doesn't know. But when I walked through the halls of the building a few weeks ago with the new owner, as workers were clearing out all the units, I saw something.
What's this?
I have no idea. Notes left from tenants, you see that a lot?
There were little green post-it notes that someone had stuck on the doors to some of the rooms with names of old tenants and the letters R.I.P., Rest in Peace. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Speaking of old buildings, as Chrissy just was, what does Marketplace have in common with a $400 tank top, a bilingual tax preparer, and a sign maker? You can find out on the latest episode of our newest podcast. It's called York and Fig, and there is a link right on our homepage, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which starts with oil up just a tick today to $41.14 a barrel. In the renewable energy space, this item, though, there's a guy in New York City who wants to take the droppings, shall we say, of the city's 600,000 dogs and using special digesters put in city parks, turn those droppings into clean energy. The pilot project comes at a cost of $100 million, but that is not the biggest problem this thing has. It's great to turn it into biofuel, one green power entrepreneur said, but first you got to pick it up. Yes, I know the Dow is not the economy, and the economy is not the Dow Jones Industrial Average, but today, ladies and gentlemen, was lousy. The Dow off 358 points, 2%. The NASDAQ down 141 points, 2.8%. The S&P 500 dropped itself 43 points lower, that is 2%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.